put it in as amendment to yours, and then we'll just testify together and tell. And then the amounts. Can we just leave them out up in the air?
Yeah, I think we'll just
put a zero. I think that then.
I think it's slightly low.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That sounds great.
Okay.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this sunny April 3rd, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3427 and ask Representative Gallegos to join us. If you talk slow, we'll have some more committee members.
Okay, yeah. We'll just take our time. You were being facetious, I think. So, Representative Chair Greenlick and committee members, or member, I'm very happy to be here. And you see, I've got a big crowd behind me listening. They came to listen to my testimony.
You hired some of them.
You know, I'm here to talk about mental health, my favorite subject. And for those of you on the committee who don't know, I was actually trained as a psychiatric social worker. So this is a bill that's very dear to my heart. What it's about is really just reimbursement for social workers. And if you don't know, social work is pretty much a feminine profession in that when I was teaching, about 90%, 95% of my students were female. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that explains why it's a low-paid profession. But we can remedy that with your help. So let me read these comments that my staff put together. House Bill 3427 is a step in the right direction in addressing the needs for greater access to mental health. The cost of health care and, in conjunction, mental health care can be one of the greatest barriers to folks receiving necessary mental health care, specifically psychotherapy. Without reasonable reimbursement rates, Oregonians will no longer have reasonable access to quality mental health. And I think we're all interested in sort of flattening out that health care cost hierarchy. And clinicians in private practice have fixed expenses that do not reflect do not flex with the sudden drops in reimbursement rates. So what this bill's about is really just to deal with the fact that insurance companies have tended recently, in the last few years, to really downgrade the reimbursement rates for psychotherapists, particularly non-medical intervention of mental health folks. So that's what this bill is about, and I'm sure you'll have further testimony from experts in the field, people who are practicing. I'm not a clinician, but I tend to confine my psychotherapy to my immediate family. So with that, I'll leave you. And as I said, I'm sure that there'll be other testimony that will support my...
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Any easy questions? No. All right.
We'll save the hard questions.
Thank you very much.
In terms of scheduling, we have three work sessions scheduled today. Two of them are being carried over. So let me announce you in case you're here for House Bill 2758, which will actually reschedule for Wednesday rather than carry over. And we have House Bill 2551, which will also reschedule for Wednesday. So if you're here on those bills, you don't have to be. I'm also going to open up a work session on House Bill 3100 simply for the purpose of introducing the Dash 1 amendments into the bill. We have the Dash 1 amendments, which are a totally rewrite of the whole bill. I want to make sure everybody knows what it is we're actually considering. So if I can have a motion, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 1, 2015.
Representative Noss moves that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3100, dated 4-1-15. Is there any discussion on the amendment, the motion? Is there any objection? So moved. Carries. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3100 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3347 and ask our majority leader to join us.
And, Mr. Chair, at the same time,
Oh, yeah. What have we got here? I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's okay.
I'm so overwhelmed by celebrity that I forgot to follow.
She would like Don Bryant, Ray Crump, and Carolyn Mason in the queue.
What's the bill, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3347 modifies the definition of person with mental illness as it is used in a civil commitment statutes.
Great. Thank you. Representative Hoyle, have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3347 and the Dash 2 amendments. It is a very simple bill, which I believe codifies the existing practice around civil commitments. There is wildly disparate interpretations of the civil commitment law depending on what county you're in, because there's different case law, because, you know, for a number of reasons. All this bill does is says that a person could be civilly committed not only when they're an immediate danger to yourself and others, but also adding to under on the second page, unable to provide for basic personal needs, and this is the additional part, including but not limited to being at risk of serious physical harm in the near future as a result of the person failing to provide for the basic personal needs that must be met to ensure a person's health or safety and is not receiving such care as necessary for health and safety.
I hear we don't have the Dash 2 amendments.
We do not have the Dash 2 amendments. Okay. The Dash 2 amendments would say that. They are much like the Dash 1 amendments. If you have the Dash 1
Which we also don't have.
Yeah. We don't have any amendments.
Well, there are amendments.
Why don't you see? That's two strikes.
While you're waiting for the amendments, I will tell you a story. In Lane County right now, civil commitments are done when someone is a danger to themselves and others, and also when there is a medical opinion that someone would be, through their actions, be dead in 2 weeks to a month, or have a high probability that they will be seriously mentally medically compromised. That is a very, very high bar. The reason I got involved in this, I think I've spoken about it many times. I have a brother who's schizophrenic and routinely will end up either in the public safety system, or if he's lucky to be in the right city that has a mental health court, ends up in the state hospital getting the care he needs. I don't think that people should end up in jail or in the public safety system because they're mentally ill or they're suffering from severe and persistent mental illness. I also have a sister who suffers from mental illness and self-medicates and routinely ends up in the public safety system. Again, I just don't think that's how we should treat people who are most vulnerable. I think on this panel, there are people who believe that government should be larger and some people that may think that it should be drowned in a bathtub. But I think what we can all agree on is that there is a place for government to protect those people who are most vulnerable. In January, I received a call from the mayor of Eugene, Kitty Piercy, and she said, because she knows I care about this issue, can you help? We have a woman. Her name is Susan Hughes. She's currently living in a tent. She's incontinent, both for urine and feces. She, and people will talk about her, she has been homeless for about 40 years. She was brutally attacked and raped when she was 27. And just is psychotic. She believes that she is being attacked all the time, so she hoards things like food and whatnot to give to the people she thinks are attacking her. Actually, you know, it seems in her mind a way to protect herself. Unfortunately, she hoards food, which becomes rancid. So she was living in a tent that was urine and feces soaked. There were rats in the tent because there was rancid food that she felt like she needed to keep. It was going to be below freezing. So I called the police chief, Pete Kearns, and I said, I'm concerned. Can we get her committed? Can we get her to the hospital? And he said, I would bring her to the hospital, and quite frankly, I've been thinking about it. We keep track of a lot of the people who are homeless and suffer from mental illness in the Eugene area, and I'm worried that Susie's not going to make it tonight. I'm worried she's going to die. Now, 10 feet away were people from the Occupy Medical Group who were trying to offer her a clean sleeping bag, clean and dry clothes, and a new tent, but she wouldn't leave her tent, and she wouldn't go into shelter because she's afraid of being attacked. So we called a number of people and we got her into the hospital because, interestingly enough, she was in on a medical hold because she had a urinary tract infection and couldn't be compliant with her medication, and it kept her for 3 days until the cold spell broke. And she got a little bit better and some of the care she needed. But when she was let out, she really decompensated because all of her things were gone. And this is a cycle that happens with her over and over again. When we went to the county to have her civilly committed, this has been tried before, what they've said is they go and talk to her in her tent, and she's not immediately suicidal. Now, because she's not immediately suicidal in Lane County, she cannot be committed. There was a case law interpreting the original civil commitment bill, which was intended through the legislature to be much broader. But Judge Merton heard a case, and in Lane County, we interpret it very narrowly. This case was spoken about at a group of human service providers, and if she'd have been in Multnomah County or Marion County, here where they have the state hospital, it would have been interpreted differently. All this does is puts into statute what I believe is current practice, and also gives people the tools they need to protect people who are really vulnerable and in need. And just for the record, this is not me wanting to put lots of people in the state hospital. I actually think there are other places. For instance, this woman, Susan Hughes, could have been put in a lower level facility that had some supervision. But when she's been given, you know, housing before, she lights things on fire to chase away the people that she thinks are attacking her. So she really can't be in a place that's unsupervised. The bottom line is, I think you've got some, I believe you've got amendments now. Very simple, very clear, small changes. You've got testimony from Bob Jundep in Disability Rights Oregon, who states that this bill would allow people to be committed because their speech or their past behavior, whether or not it was related to a mental disorder, or the reasonable fear of third parties that generated by the person's behavior. And I think that this is a misinterpretation and misrepresentation of the bill as written. We were in communication with the criminal defense attorneys who helped us come up with a more narrow amendment to this bill, and I want to thank them for their work. I did invite Bob Jundep from Disability Rights Oregon to come speak to me, and I believe people have been in contact with him about the amendments that were made. He never did come speak to me, so this, I would like you to... I would like it to be acknowledged that this testimony is against the original bill as written, and again, does not reflect the bill as amended, as we would like to see passed. So I'd like you to take that into consideration. And again, this isn't about getting more people into the state hospital. This is about protecting people who really don't have the ability to provide for basic needs. I don't think that someone should die in the cold simply because they suffer from severe and persistent mental illness. The fact, and they can't make choices that would allow them to be protected. We wouldn't treat anyone who was physically ill in that manner. And in 2007, many of you that are here voted to that we would have a law that we would treat mental illness and physical illness with parity. And so that's what I'm asking you to do. This is vitally important. It is a tool that codifies the original intent of the law and the practice in many counties. But we need this tool to protect those who really are most vulnerable.
Okay, thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Sure.
I'm going to ask everybody, we have a lot of testimony and a lot of bills, so please, all of you, try and keep it as brief as you can to make your point.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, I am Dan Bryant. I'm senior minister of First Christian Church in Eugene at 12th and Oak, a historic downtown church. In the fall of 1998, I was listening to a broadcast on KLCC, our local NPR affiliate, as they were talking about a 65-year-old Portland woman who was killed by a Eugene man with a long history of mental illness. And they said, We knew something like this would happen. We just didn't know which of our clients it would be. That woman killed was my mother. It was devastating not just for our family, but also for the family in whose home Mom was killed in North Eugene. Mom's sister, who Mom had sent away so that she could work with her nephew without interference of her sister, was the owner of that home. And that decision may have saved her sister's life, but it cost her her own, as her nephew, my cousin, stabbed my mother more than a dozen times with a kitchen knife. It's ironic I should be here giving this testimony on Good Friday. My mother gave her life for her nephew she loved and mistakenly believed he would never hurt her. I tell you this story not because I believe that the proposed amendment that Representative Hoyle has presented would have helped my mother, probably wouldn't have, but because my mother could not be here today to tell you that we as a society must do more to help those who, due to their mental illness, cannot help themselves. And as a pastor of a downtown church, I cannot begin to tell you how often we see people who are in dire straits because of their mental condition. Hardly a day goes by anymore that we don't have a homeless person in our office, confused, hungry, often delusional in one way or another, and incapable of making rational decisions. I think of Brandon, who can be seen wandering the streets of downtown Eugene most every day with a blanket over his head, even on the warmest of days, comes to us for a snack about once or twice a week. Or Cheryl, who sits in our office, which she thinks of as her own office, sometimes for hours, writing legal briefs in neat handwriting with perfect spelling and which make absolutely no sense to anyone but her. But the case that breaks my heart is the case of Susan Hughes that Representative Hoyle has told you about. And I want to tell you about a story before Representative Hoyle became involved in her case. Susan is a tiny woman, maybe 90 pounds fully clothed, severely traumatized, battling homeless for the last couple of decades. She deals with her trauma, true, by self-medicating with a variety of legal and illegal drugs. She has a loving sister who has done her best to assist her but cannot force Susie to do what she needs to do for her own care. She came to my attention when volunteers with Occupy Medical informed me that Susie would not make it through another winter without shelter. And indeed, without the persistent care of that group, she would have lost most of her toes from a severe case of frostbite from sleeping outside in freezing weather. So we put Susie in one of our Conestoga huts behind the church, and I've provided a picture of that move-in day. She was quite happy. We had a group of volunteers who checked in on her regularly, and for the first month, all went well. Her health showed steady improvement. But the demons, and that's, I know, not a very scientific term, that's the best I know to describe what I observed, began to get the best of her. She made one bad choice after another. People she associated with, items she brought into her hut, drugs she took. And then one afternoon, in a delusional fit, she started a fire inside her hut. And mind you, this hut is just 60 square feet of space in an attempt to get protection from non-existent tormentors. Fortunately, a passerby saw the smoke, called 911. When the firefighters arrived on the scene, pounded on the locked door, assuming the hut to be empty with their axe ready to break the door in, they were surprised when Susie herself opened the door. They took her to the hospital to deal with the smoke inhalation, which we learned could have been fatal had she remained in her hut much longer. And so if you look at the next pictures, you'll see the condition of the hut that we found inside and just absolutely horrid conditions, even though we had volunteers checking on her on a regular basis, but in the last week she wouldn't let them in. Clearly, she was a danger to herself as well as to the church, and so we could not allow her to return. We assumed that she would be committed, submitted testimony to the social worker to support that end. We were surprised and troubled that she was not committed and that she was soon released on the hospital and back on the street.
Sir, I'm going to ask you to speed up. We have a whole room full of people.
Well, let me just conclude. Bills. You see the pictures, the case of how critical it is. I think most people would conclude that she was incapable of caring for herself and needed great care. And I strongly support this amendment for that reason. And I would just note that My mother lost her life because of the failure of our system to provide for her care when she, her nephew most needed it. And I would request that we do something now to prevent another unnecessary, untimely death so that Susie will not be the next. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have a daughter with schizophrenia. About
you say, introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. I'm Ray Crump from Florence, Oregon. Have a daughter that's 37 years old that's had, well, mental illness from about the age of about 12, escalating, getting on drugs somewhere along there, and has had schizophrenia for years and years. Hasn't lived with me very much during that time, but the last 4 years she spent quite a bit of time at my place, and I've had an RV there. She lived in my house for a while, and I mean, I could start telling you stories of when she was in Vegas for a year or on the streets of Compton for a year and a half, and rapes, being abused, and the crimes she's committed. It just goes on and on. But the police forces currently that I'm dealing with, when they come out to my house, which is pretty regular because I call them often, they basically say they don't have laws in place that allow them to pick her up. I've held the phone up in my house, and they could hear the shouts from her RV. Broken windows, burned mattresses, all the pictures that he shows there are pretty accurate of what you get when you get somebody with no medication, and then they get on street drugs. And she's actually in the Florence jail as we speak, and she will be interviewed by a commitment officer on Monday under current law. And this has happened before where they've just released her, and she has been committed in the past, but it was only after a cutting incident where she cut herself about 20 times, tried to say I did it. The police saw kind of through that and threw her in jail for a while, and she actually responded pretty well at a foster home for about 9 months. As soon as she was released from the foster home and went on her own, which was to a boyfriend's house, she immediately went into decline. Got back on street drugs. All stabilization efforts up to that point were wasted because there was no housing. So I guess I'm going a little bit beyond what this bill says, but there at least needs to be an entry level for a person that has severe mental illness to get help. And this is the bare minimum. There needs to be a lot more discussion about where to go from here, but at least this is a step in the right direction. It gives the commitment officers a chance to actually commit somebody instead of saying it's not bad enough.
Thank you very much. I'm going to suspend the hearing on this bill to take testimony from Representative Gilliam on another bill. We're going to have real problems getting everybody in today, so I'm going to ask everybody to be as brief as they possibly can. Is that 3200?
Yes.
We're going to open up a hearing on 3200. Keep this hearing open. Open a hearing on 3200 and take Representative Gilliam's brief testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3200 prohibits a health care provider and health insurers from denying a patient 65 years of age or older health care or reimbursement of costs of health necessary to prevent death based on advanced age.
Representative Gilliam is calling this the Greenlick Bill, I understand.
Mr. Chair, I am not. It's a pleasure to be here. Vic Gilliam, State Representative Silverton. And it's... I appreciate you giving me this time just for a second in such a serious and moving day of testimony on other bills. And I know you'll get back to this one in due course. when this bill came to my attention, I was particularly interested because of my work with Representative Hoyle on our ongoing elder abuse prevention task force. And all I'm here to say is that this is not an accusatory bill. This is a bill that to start a conversation along the lines that you and I talked about, Mr. Chair, so that we can avoid possible national trends in this area of just possible discrimination, and also to underline our commitment in Oregon to protecting the lives of our most treasured and at times most vulnerable Oregonians. So I'm going to leave it, when you get back to this bill, I'm going to leave it to the perspective of a number of people who are in this room. And lastly, I would say, having just listened to the testimony on a couple of other bills, I want to thank each and every one of you on this committee for your service on a very important area for Oregonians, and including this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. So, should we go back together?
Sure.
We're going to call some more witnesses on the prior bill. We're going to ask you to hold your testimony to 2 minutes. They say we've got several bills and a lot of people to get to today, and a lot of people have come here for a long way. So, would you please call the next panel?
Carolyn Mason. Then I'm going to Becky Child, Drake Eubank,
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name's Carolyn Mason, and I'm a lieutenant with the Eugene Police Department, where I've worked for over 19 years. I've had a lot of experience with mental illness, having been the mental health liaison for my department to the community, and I was personally involved in the Susan Hughes case that was just discussed. Having been involved with the community of mental health, I've seen people that have done well on medication and treatment. I've seen them in emergent crisis, and I've seen those with persistent mental illness who become medically fragile, as Susan did in this case. I've worked with all these populations and those that serve them, and I've seen firsthand the tragedies that befall some of them who slip through the cracks because of the broadness, or the vagueness, I should say, of the original bill that we're here to make an amendment to. My most recent experience was with Susan. She's now a senior citizen. She's homeless, living on the streets. And as you heard, the temperatures were freezing, and she was living in squalor. She was soaked in urine. There was feces. She had rats in the tent. She called them her pets. She refused to leave. All the people there at the camp tried to convince her to leave, and she wouldn't. Val and the chief and the mayor, everybody calls me and says, Lieutenant Mason, what can you do from the law enforcement perspective to get Susan into the hospital on a police hold? And unfortunately, because of the way the statute is written with dangerous to self or others, it doesn't constitute the medical aspect of it. So I had no ability to take her against her will and take her to the hospital where she could be treated. It was only because of the sheer number of volunteers and the organizations that rallied around Susan that they were able to convince her to go voluntarily to the hospital, where they managed to get her to stay for 3 days to get her stable. I truly believe, just as the chief had reiterated to Val, that had she stayed in that tent, if we had would have left her there, she would have froze in her own urine. The pictures don't do justice to what I saw in the tent. And from my experience, having been a patrol officer for 19 years, she is just one of hundreds that I have seen on the street. And she's the one that everybody rallied for. So, because of the basic definitions now in place, it doesn't provide law enforcement, mental health providers, or even physicians the ability to act. And I would just recommend and hope that you will approve the proposed amendment and help all of us working with the mentally ill to better help all the Susans out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink and committee members. My name is Becky Child. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am somebody who was put on a notice of mental illness several years ago. I've been hospitalized more than 20 times and have been homeless 3 times in my life. I now am an adjunct professor at Portland State and teach social work. I'm opposed to this bill and the amendments. I also had to help with a dear friend who was in a very precarious situation this last spring or winter and fall, and I just am really concerned that we do not do enough engagement, that our health care system is not focused on engaging people who are really hurting and really struggling. And as somebody who works in the system, has advocated for people who don't get their needs met, who get kicked out by providers, who are really hard to work with, I don't think this bill is going to solve the problem. In addition, I think it does broaden it to the point that I wouldn't want anything to do with it. I would do anything I could to avoid getting treatment based off of this bill. because if the mental health system, unfortunately, is not a good system. And people who get hospitalized, if they're really intent on hurting themselves, they can figure out how to do that. We have evidence of that from the state hospital and other local hospitals where people have killed themselves while they were in the hospital when they were supposedly safe. And so I think that there's other work that needs to be done. I don't think that changing the statute will accomplish what people are hoping it will accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Drake Eubank. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm a qualified mental health associate and have provided Medicaid services over time. I'm currently a personal care attendant for two of the clients that were orphaned when my agency was closed, much in the same sense that Susan Hughes was actually orphaned. I have more information than probably has been presented here, but I'm bound by HIPAA not to speak to that. I know that her information has also been on the front page of the Eugene Register Guard. So it's a very emotional issue for a lot of people, and there are a lot of people in the peer community in Eugene that actually know her and have. She's been around for quite a while. That being said, Becky makes a pretty good point about the treatment system. The answer to all of this is getting more treatment and more help for people. The real problem is nobody looks at the qualitative aspect of that or even looks at the perspective of the people that actually receive the services. If this was a friendly, user-friendly, welcoming system, you wouldn't have anywhere near the problem that you have getting people to participate. You have people that are choosing jail rather than to choose treatment. On top of that, if you increased the commitment process, which the first version of this bill was pretty dramatic, where if I have a mental health diagnosis, which I do, and I destroy something like throw a telephone against the wall, that would have been criteria to commit me before into the, and that was okay. People look at that and it just you know, again, a therapeutic issue. It's not. You're creating a system where you're on one side trying to create participation, on the other side you're trying to force people into treatments that they don't necessarily want. And in the case of people that lack insight, that's a big discussion. But when you consider that most of the people here will say that they need to be on medication, the science right now says that 4 in 10 people will have their lives shortened just from simply the treatments. People in the public mental health system die 25 years earlier as it is now. And 40% of those causes are tracked down to causes related to the treatments that they're being provided. So, you know, it ends up being 6 of 1 or 6 of another. So I really would like to speak against expanding the criteria. If you're going to ruin somebody's life along the way, that doesn't need to have their life ruined. Thank you.
Are you supporting or opposing the bill?
I'm opposing any expansion of the commitment laws. We have really good laws.
Thank you.
As they exist now.
Chair?
Yes.
I have a quick question, yep, of the officer. You said that there were hundreds that you come into contact with. Is there any guess under this kind of bill how many you might actually solely commit besides Susie in a year?
Well, I have a running tally of folks that are on my list to try to find services for that might meet this bill, and I would guess it would be less than 10 of those people.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I make a comment to that question?
Very briefly, please.
I have clients that are taken into the jail that are psychotic. The jails have an obligation to assess them. The jails, rather than do that and go through the process of committing them to the state hospital, if they're unfit to proceed, will release them back onto the street rather than do the assessment. So that's something people need to keep in mind, too, is that the way the jails run their operations really has an effect on what she's talking about as well. She may be able to speak that.
Thank you. Okay. Would you call the next panel, please?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Schultz. Mayor Pete Tranks. And would you tell me the third person?
Yeah,
Scott Winkle. Thank you.
Good
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I am proud to say that for the first time in the League's history, the League has prioritized mental health reform as part of its legislative agenda. I'm going to tell you very briefly how that came about. In our general government policy committee that addresses public safety issues, someone brought up the concerns we were having, a number of cities were having with mental health issues, and the mayor, the chair of that committee, the city manager of Springfield, said, pulled out his cell phone, put it on the table, and he said, when this goes off on the weekend, it's my police chief, and he's going to tell me that something bad happened, and more often than not, that bad thing happened in relation to someone with mental illness, and I'm sick of it. And that is, and we developed some policies based on that incident. We've identified a number of deficiencies in the mental health arena. Again, cities are not supposed to be mental health service providers, but we have built a system that results in the first time a person receiving services is when a 911 call is made. And I will submit to this committee that despite intentions to the otherwise, what we have built is not humane. We've identified a number of deficiencies, some of those deficiencies in terms of resources, not just in the amount, but in how they're going, how they are spent. And we have identified some deficiencies in the statutes. One of the deficiencies in the statute is in our civil commitment area. The way I read this statute, and I will confess I'm new to this and I may be making a mistake, is that a person who is threatening self-harm with a weapon or with immediate means can be civilly committed. But a person who is using a longer-term method through self-neglect but is still going to end up committing self-harm, resulting in self-harm or in death, cannot be civilly committed. That is how I read the statute, and I believe the statute, and I believe this bill with the amendments does correct that. With me today are Mayor Pete Truax from Forest Grove, the League's president, and Chief Janie Schutz, the Chief of Police of Forest Grove, would like to tell you their stories briefly.
And you support the bill, I take it.
I support the bill.
Yes, sir.
Good.
Please introduce
yourself. I think I've gotten the nod,
ma'am,
from my mayor. How are you, sir? Representative Greenlick committee members. For the record, my name is Janie Schutz. I am the police chief of Forest Grove. I've been in law enforcement for 27 years. And I wanted to quickly talk to you initially about what I look at as the more humanistic approach, because law enforcement is many times the first line of defense in any of the calls that someone in our community sees as necessary or wants intervention. I looked at four elements that really do and have caused some issues for law enforcement: deinstitutionalization at some point, mainly because of the lack of community services that come to match what is out there for the ability for people to have a quality of life. I looked at criminalization, and I looked at that because of the jails and prisons are now becoming, with the numbers, a large percentage of our population in jails and prisons is partly made up of someone that has some form of mental illness. I looked at medicalization. I called it that because we are allowing people and trying to give them their medication, and we've heard from self-medication, and many times, though, without some supervision, a lot of people, some clients, are using drugs and or alcohol along with that, causing more of issues for them. And I looked at privatization, which, again, needs, in my mind, just to a continued watch over so we can ensure that people are getting what they need. Almost every day across the United States, there's some sort of news story about someone's taken their life or another. And on many occasions, it's been determined that there's been some form of mental illness. It's also been reported that half of those killed during these encounters with the police every year have some form of mental illness. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, about 6% of the U.S. population, 1 in 17, have mental illness. And across the United States, prisons and jails now house 10 times more individuals with mental illness than a hospital. Problems associated come with law enforcement. We give them many tools. I will, sir. Thank you. We give our officers many tools, crisis intervention training, but they are not medical doctors. They are not social workers. They are not mental health workers. And we have to either give the officers more opportunities to have better tools at their side or the encouragement of mental health. In essence, I just looked at it as a measurement, sir, that when something doesn't work, we continue to measure, and if it doesn't meet the measurement, we try to bring it up to par. And I looked at House Bill 3347 as doing that, and I'm here to stand by it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlink, I'm Pete Truax, the mayor of the city of Forest Grove and the president of the League of Oregon Cities. I just want to reiterate what the chief has told us. Each week, Forest Grove's police department publishes in local newspapers a police log. Sometimes it's humorous, such as the lady that got trapped in one of our flooded roads because she was following her GPS, and it said it was all right to go under the flooded road. But other times, that material is not quite so humorous. Police assist after a girl became upset with her parents and started cutting her leg with a razor. Officers responded to another fight between a mother and daughter. The mother was bitten on the hand during the fight. The daughter reportedly tried to jump out the window. So these are the kinds of things that our police department in Forest Grove, a city of 22,000, has to deal with on a weekly basis. If I get nothing else out of this, I was reminded by Representative Hoyle's comments earlier today. One of my heroes was Hubert Humphrey. And the old warrior once said, the moral test of a nation, of a government, is how it cares for those in the dawn of life, the very young, how it cares for those in the sunset of life, the elderly, and how it cares for those in the shadows of life, the poor, the disenfranchised, the otherwise challenged. We have an opportunity here to take care of those in the shadows of life and do what the happy warrior says we ought to be doing. I want to thank you for all your work, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Get the next panel up. Next panel, please.
Cheryl Ramirez, Elizabeth Wakefield, Jack Hasrick. No, I was just somebody.
Are we missing?
Yeah, that's okay. You guys can go.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez, the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'm testifying on the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3347. I haven't seen the Dash 2 amendment yet. We empathize and understand the intent for which the bill was introduced, and we do agree with the removal of the language in the first version of grave disability and relating to presenting a likelihood of physical harm. Our testimony is really around the several commitment bills that have been introduced this session, and given the interest in community mental health system redesign, we believe we should evaluate the commitment statutes globally as a part of the larger system improvements. We also recommend that the systematic process be done during the 15-17 biennium, since statute changes could impact challenges that Oregon Health Authority is already struggling with, like the state hospital wait list and acute care capacity, as well as our agreement with the US DOJ to ensure that people with serious and persistent mental illness are in the least restrictive settings possible. And then, of course, we always suggest considering practical community-based alternatives to involuntary commitment first. I mentioned in my written testimony a circumstance for people who are intoxicated or under the influence of controlled substances and considered incapacitated, a special hold that's called a safety hold or a hospital hold for A&D. I know it doesn't relate to the person who this bill was around, but I heard a lot of people talk about those who are incapacitated because of intoxication. It just gives... it kind of buys some time. It's up to 48 hours in which the person can get an appropriate assessment, and the community can find alternatives for that person in the community if at all possible. So I'd like that to be considered as well. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
And you're opposing the bill in its current form?
Well, we're not opposing. We're neutral because we do like that the language changed from the first to the second version.
You might like some dash to it even better, huh?
Yes.
Next, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Wakefield, and I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in support of the Dash 2 amendments that Representative Hoyle spoke of. I want to thank Representative Hoyle for taking the time to meet with my organization about her concern about our concerns of the original bill and why we felt the Dash 2 amendments were the important next step. I'm an attorney at the Metropolitan Public Defender, where I represent both adults and juveniles with mental health and sometimes their family members. I've represented people with mental illness in both criminal court as well as in civil commitments and in juvenile court. And I was our staff attorney in our mental health court in Multnomah County since its beginning until the middle of last year, so for about 4 years. The Dash 2 amendments propose a couple of changes that are fairly significant. One is that current case law talks about an imminent risk of death. And the language in the statute sort of softens that a little bit and talks about the serious physical harm or risk of serious harm. So it does open that up a little bit. We're not talking about immediate death. And it also codifies something the Court of Appeals has really looked at, which is the temporal connection, the temporal limitation or the time connection. It isn't just that there is some non-speculative threat that may happen to somebody in the future. Any of us might get hit by a bus. But it has to be something that is connected to the mental health diagnosis, and that being the reason that they are unable to, that they are at risk of death or serious harm at the time of the hearing. So it clarifies a lot of what the Court of Appeals has been telling the courts that they wanted. The case law is very factual in these cases. There's a lot of discussion about how nobody gets committed. As you read the cases, what the Court of Appeals doesn't say is you can't get committed under these facts. What it says is the government didn't bring the right evidence here. What I see happening in Multnomah County for a long time is there's a police officer who's available to come to court and testify, and they've only seen one narrow, tiny piece. They don't have the back history that a family member might have, and they don't have the expertise that a mental health professional might have. And so there is that aspect, and I suspect
that
does, I will. That does affect the county-by-county interpretation. It's my understanding there will be a work group. This is obviously an incredibly complicated situation with lots of different voices, and we would very much support that and hope to participate in that. I'm happy to answer any other questions or be available at a later time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack Hotchick. I'm a retired psychologist. Worked in the public mental health system here in Oregon for 23 years, 4 years as the manager of Linn County Mental Health Services, and then the remainder of the time at Oregon State Hospital. I'm opposed to House Bill 3347 because of the temporal piece in particular having to do with how we even predict dangerousness. The prediction validity for dangerousness is poor. There is no statistical validity to support the ability to predict violence and risk of violence for any kind of serious harm to self, others. There are approaches by which we can identify circumstances in which the person becomes more likely possibly to act in a violent way. Those factors, though, cannot predict longer term. There's no sensibility to trying to project out what an individual might do. What we are going to be doing is ensnaring individuals who have decompensated in their functioning ability, in response to environmental factors when they need support and help with those environmental factors. You have heard many individuals come here to talk about the need for community services, and yet what we're advocating is that we abridge some individual civil rights as a shortcut instead of providing those community services. If you happen to become an individual who would be so subjected to this kind of scrutiny, there is a very good chance you would not, as Becky Child indicated, you would not even approach your community mental health center because you would fear for this misunderstanding. Many individuals spontaneously recover from a period of declined functionality. We would be ensnaring those individuals, not giving them the opportunity or providing the services by which we know they will improve. And so we will then be burdening the court system. We will be moving people through, and as the person said, you will be sending them back to the community mental health services to get those services if they're there.
Would you wrap up?
There are no more services. That's the key problem. We can prevent these violence episodes by providing the basic need services at the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you call the next witness, please?
And I apologize ahead of time. Michael Helbet Chuk? Yeah. You stood up already. Good job. Chris Simpson. Patricia Ross. And Bob Jundev. Oh, sorry. I didn't see you come in.
Please introduce yourself.
Representative Chair Grinlick, my name is Michael Liebichuk, and I'm here to provide this testimony in opposition to House Bill 3347. This bill will create more problems than it will solve. Oregon's existing civil commitment laws currently provide a workable path to civil commitment. Lowering the bar to civil commitment will result in needless hospitalizations and a greater loss of civil rights for a sizable swath of individuals. I have been civilly committed three times, the first time in 1979 and the last time in 1991. In the course of 19 years, I was hospitalized 20 times, seven of which were in state hospital settings. I've been diagnosed with paranoid-type schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. My symptoms resulted from a traumatic event when I was 15 years of age. Had this trauma been addressed with treatments that are available today, I doubt that I would have needed to be hospitalized even once. It took me over a year to get my life back on track following my first state hospitalization in 1979. I felt like an anathema following that hospitalization. My self-esteem was at an all-time low. I felt like the scourge of the earth, and I became more symptomatic as a result. This all changed in 1987 when I was elected first president of the board of Mind Empowered Incorporated, the first publicly funded mental health consumer-run agency in Oregon. I learned from my fellow board members that I did not need to live by the dictates of a treatment plan written by a case manager who did not know me well. I could take the reins of my life, make my own decisions, and become a responsible adult. As I took control of my life improved. As my life improved, I was more thoughtful into the decisions that I made since I had more to gain and more to lose. My mental health recovery had begun. I had been hospitalized 17 times from 1976 to 1987 when I got involved with Mind Empowered Incorporated. I've been hospitalized three times since 1987, the last time occurring shortly after being married in 1998. If you've been married, you might understand how this can happen. I have more humor in here, but I'm getting a buzzer, so I'll cut this to the chase. Essentially, community supports like Mind Empowered are what's needed. This bill, if enacted, could cost the state $80 million per fiscal. Mm-hmm. That's an estimate that I've heard, and I have inside ears to it, though I can't tell you how I have those inside ears. Those dollars could be far better invested in community supports, where we can help people along the path of recovery rather than giving them the terrible derailment in life that a hospitalization can amount to. Thanks so much for hearing my testimony.
Thank you.
Hi.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. This is my first time testifying. My name is Chris Simpson, and I just want to say amen to the person before Mike. It didn't catch his name, but amen to that. I'm a resident of Marion County, and I currently serve as the Executive Director of Recovery Outreach Community Center, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting recovery from mental health challenges, including addiction and trauma. Through my experience at this organization, I've been in close contact with hundreds of Oregonians recovering from these challenges. I stand opposed to this House bill that would expand the form of incarceration known as civil commitment in the state of Oregon. I suffered from serious mental health problems that emerged while I was an undergraduate at Stanford University and continued through my graduate education at the School of Public Health at Emory University. Although I haven't experienced civil commitment myself, it's become increasingly obvious to me through my work in community mental health that I could have gone in that direction myself if I hadn't enjoyed the privileges that come with a good education and having people in my life who protected my ability to act autonomously. Now I work daily with people who lack these supports. I believe that this bill particularly discriminates against people living in poverty and people who, through no fault of their own, lacked adequate education as children and thus are unable to speak for themselves when they're in a clinical setting. Health science research backs me up on this, showing that more educated people, when presenting to mental health professionals with the exact same symptoms as less affluent, less educated ones, will describe their experiences to clinicians using different words and in different ways that are more familiar to clinicians' ears, resulting in different diagnoses. This produces a subtle but important bias in clinical practice, which makes poor people and less educated people more likely to be diagnosed with more stigmatizing disorders like schizophrenia, putting them at greater risk for incarceration. This bill would make discrimination against the less educated, which already exists, even worse by broadening the list of situations that warrant involuntary commitment. Instead of furthering the divide between what poor Oregonians and more well-off Oregonians can expect from life in Oregon, this House should be working to close that gap.
Are you done?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Hi.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Patricia Ross. And I'm going to tell you a story. I was in a terrible relationship, and I had the lowest self-esteem of my life. I'd go weeks without showering, not wanting to experience the intensity of the trigger of standing under the showerhead, flooded with memories of the abuse I endured as a child. I didn't eat anything that didn't come from the window of a drive-thru. I thought about jumping from every tall building I encountered. I wanted a hard landing, never the water. I'd been raped months before. With my abusive stepfather's pending prison release, I wondered if he would come after me after he got out. I knew he'd blame me for his prison sentence. I started to see fleeting images of myself with a handgun to my forehead or my temple. Intrusive thoughts flooded my mind, images not unlike those of a flashback, quick, invasive, unpredictable. I didn't go see a therapist once that year. I was terrified of trusting someone enough to open up to them, only to end up hospitalized against my will. You see, I've worked in the mental health system for 9 years. I've seen the inside of those walls. A person becomes simply a danger to themselves or a danger to someone else. In other states, a person who can't take care of themselves, like what's being proposed here. The clinicians become the saviors who will teach the dangerous person life skills so that they'll no longer have a desire to end their lives or to hurt others. Meanwhile, I thought of myself alone in that place, without my phone or my soft blanket or Caprica, my little Pomeranian, the only things that got me through the next moment sometimes. One night I stood outside of a meditation group looking at the stars. The warm air and the crisp breeze that night presented me with two choices. Drive to Portland and find my way to the top of the highest building in sight, or drive to my friend's house and pray that he was home. I called him on the way, panicked and desperate. I knew I could tell him the truth and that he wouldn't panic. I knew he was familiar with the desperation I was feeling, because we'd spent hours talking about the times he felt it when it was still so foreign to me, before the thoughts of dying ever crept into my own mind for the first time. My friend sat with me for hours. He held my hand. I cried and I panicked and I drifted off to sleep for a few minutes every once in a while, exhausted from the intensity of my emotions.
Months later, another friend found a way to talk to me about the showers I wasn't taking in a way that made me laugh. He made sure I had a good meal every day. He called me first thing in the morning to make sure I was up and ready for the day. Sometimes he'd do this for weeks at a time. Another friend brought me to Celebrate Recovery and encouraged me to work through the 12 steps. As the months passed, I began to shower again. I started dancing. Suddenly, I hadn't taken a single drink in months, then a year. Then one day, I couldn't remember the last time that I'd thought about dying.
I need to ask you to wrap up, please.
The point is that I didn't need an institution to save me from my suicidal thoughts and intentions. I needed a friend. I didn't need force. I was no different than the people who were targeted by this bill. I had a history of mental illness, and I was losing control of my actions and was actively avoiding clinical care. And I didn't need a hospital. I needed many things, but being forced into a hospital against my will was not on the list. In fact, in my traumatized state, it would have made things much worse for me. Clearly, I oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your story. We really appreciate all you guys. It's very hard to do, I know, to be here. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you call the next panel, please?
Okay.
We have two more?
Two more. Clay Peterson and Bob Yundef.
Are we going to go to three?
Yes.
We have permission to go from 2:45 to 3, which we didn't have before, so but please keep it moving.
But I know you all hate us.
Three of us. I know. Yeah. We can skip it.
Let's take the short one next. The short one
next. You're one.
You want me first?
Sure.
Yes. Okay.
No,
you want to?
Okay.
Bob will finish.
All right.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you so much for a chance to give testimony on this bill. The story of Susan that we heard, you know, earlier in this hearing, I think is a very powerful one. But when I hear it, I don't hear the need to put someone into commitment of, in some kind of institution. What I hear instead is a immense distrust of the clinical system. And this is something that I think as an employee of ROC, the Recovery Community Outreach Center, that Chris before me is also a part of, I see every day. People are very hesitant and scared of what the system is going to do to them, and it leads them to avoiding treatment at all costs. We can talk about the policy issues, which I also think are not on the side of doing this. But I think that it's really important to look at the perception of what people will do if it becomes easier to commit people, or even if we pass a bill that makes it so that it appears to be easier to commit people. You know, changing definitions of this is something that maybe needs to be done. I know that there's some unclarity about it, but doing anything that helps to expand the amount of people that can be legally committed is going to only make people more hesitant to do any kind of treatment, more hesitant to reach out to friends and family even, and definitely more hesitant to reach out to any kind of professional source for treatment. And getting rid of that stigma, because is the most important thing, making it so that people feel like when they are approached by someone from a hospital that they could voluntarily go to, we want people to be able to do that, and that means changing the system and changing the way that we talk about this. We've had decades of trying to deinstitutionalize, and as we have changing the bill to go away from that process of deinstitutionalizing and destigmatizing is only going to make people more paranoid and make them more fearful of doing this. Even if the policy reasons for doing this you think are wise, which again I disagree with, I think that just the perception of it will make it so that those policy positives would never come to fruition, because you're going to have people evading the system and holding themselves back in ways that you might not expect.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Yundef, the director of Disability Rights Oregon. I've been an advocate on mental health issues for people who were labeled mentally ill for about 30 years. That's got me very deep into the weeds into some of these issues, and I understand that there are many, many ways to go about addressing them. They're all interrelated, and they have they're very, very important. Unfortunately, they also take money in order to address. I'd just like to make a couple of points. I've submitted written testimony. My first point is that part of my work has always been founded upon the idea that you need to listen to people who are the recipients of services in any sector of public services. There's a phrase in the disability world that says, nothing about me without me. That means that when making public policy decisions, it's very, very important to listen to the people who are directly affected. And I think that we should all take that to heart. The second thing is that I think there are complicated factors that go into making decisions. I think it's easy to think that you could change a word in the statute and have some sort of significant impact upon a very, very difficult problem. My experience tells me that isn't the case, that we need a comprehensive approach, and that that comprehensive approach is most likely to be effective if you have all the parties at the table. If you have the parents at the table, law enforcement at the table, mental health people at the table, state people at the table, and most particularly the people who are affected by the services. The last thing I'll say is that I understand the legislative process, and this has been a difficult one for me because I've been asked, well, do you oppose or do you are you in favor of this?
I was about to ask you that.
And I'll just say that I'm in favor of improving mental health services to people in the state of Oregon, and I firmly believe that the individual who's been talked about today should have services that services could have been provided to her under the existing legal standards. Either through the commitment standard, which I think covers her situation, or through guardianship, through our new public guardianship system, which is you've established, through one of the two new commitment processes that were established in 2013. And if that didn't happen, there's another problem here, and we need to solve it. So I'm going to duck the question.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was going to change the question to, are you in favor of improving the civil commitment process?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat
the question? Was, do you favor improving the civil commitment process?
Chair Greenlight, yes, indeed.
So if you don't favor the -2s, you might favor working on looking at the problem generally?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3427. And is that right?
No.
No, I'm sorry. I missed that. We'll leave that one open.
Closing 3347.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 3347 and open the public hearing on 3178.
Correct.
3178. What's that bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3178 modifies requirements for
pharmacists. Can I say something?
Sure.
For all those of you that have been down here for the first time, I hope you found this a worthwhile process and not quite as scary as you thought it was. Go ahead, please.
No, House Bill 3178 modifies requirements for pharmacy benefit managers with respect to maximum allowable cost lists. Was introduced at the request of Representative Greg Smith. Representative Smith is here. Ann Murray and Jerry Yankopal are called to the table.
Murray, good to see you again.
Can we commit a homicide?
Representative Smith, go for it.
Good afternoon, colleagues, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Milton Freewater, Hermiston, Stanfield, Umatilla, and then Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County.
Is that in Oregon?
Is that in Oregon? Colleagues,
I have two counties.
Colleagues, I'm going to keep my comments very, very brief because I want to give give Mr. Yenchapal and Ms. Murray an opportunity to share with you what's going on in rural Eastern Oregon. But I do want to leave just one thought with you. Our rural pharmacies in our small little rural communities are important. These are local entrepreneurs that provide not only excellent health care to folks in rural Eastern Oregon, but they're also providing rural economic development. It's essential for our communities to have these independent pharmacies. And so we're about to dive into discussions that sometimes goes over my head, so I'm going to turn to my colleagues to share their thoughts with you, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask them also to be as brief as you can.
Mr. Chair, are we on House Bill 3178 or House Bill 2875?
3178. It's
over. Okay. So I'm going to ask you to modify. Share your comments still, but just modify.
You have comments on both of them. I'll open up.
Yeah.
I'll open up the public hearing on 2875, and you can talk about both of them.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My name is Ann Murray. I'm a pharmacist from Heppner, Oregon. Our family has Murray Drug in Heppner and Condon, a family business serving Eastern Oregon since 1959 with three generations of pharmacists, six licensed pharmacists in our family, one in school. We serve Morrow, Gillam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties. In Morrow, we're one of two pharmacies, and we're the only pharmacy for Gillam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties. I'm here today to urge you to support House Bill 2875, which is legislation to strengthen an existing law that was passed in 2013, number 2123. It's necessary to be sure that the original intent of the law is complied with and to reinforce this intent to prevent loopholes that we have seen happening, not just in our state but in others. As I testified and explained in 2013 and what's happened in other states, we need this strengthened law to provide transparency for insurers, freedom of access and choice for patients, and a fair and competitive marketplace in the healthcare marketplace. Major amendments within 2875 have to do with closing loopholes regarding how PBMs, that's pharmacy benefit managers, reimburse pharmacies on generic drugs commonly known as MAC, or maximal allowable cost. Critical points include loopholes whereby the PBMs avoid the intent of the law, such as wording that includes, well, the pharmacy contracting with the PBM. Well, a lot of us use PSAOs, which are groups that contract with the PBM, and we've seen sometimes that they say, well, that doesn't apply to us because we, you know, you use a PSAO instead of just directly. Other things such as they say they're updating the MAC, but we found that, well, they might be updating the MAC, but they're not using.
Explain the MAC, please.
What?
Will you explain the MAC?
MAC is maximum allowable cost. They determine that what they're going to pay per pill on a generic, but they don't explain the methodology of where they get that pricing.
You don't have to be that close to the mic.
Sorry.
You can just, there you go.
Okay.
It's very sensitive. Thank
okay.
you.
We need electronic format easy to access their MAC lists. They're not doing that. They were supposed to update their MACs every 7 days and reply to our appeals. They're not doing that. We want the right to refuse to fill a prescription when it's below our cost, because under contract now they say we have to give it out anyway, even when it's way below our cost. I brought an example of a bottle. It's actually a mental health med, if anyone's still here from mental health, chlorpromazine. It's empty, though. And it shows you, if you want to see the stickers, one was purchased in October of 14 for $229. By March, it was $731. And so that's what we deal with, the changes in the marketplace based on shortages or whatever, but PBMs don't adjust their payment to the pharmacies. They have no reason to, because, they make more spread on that prescription if they don't, increase what it costs us. We're forced to dispense that prescription based on contract, and if we are out of contract, if we say, I'm sorry, we can't fill your prescription because it's below our cost. And so for this prescription that I dispensed, it cost me $668 for the quantity that I dispensed, and I was paid $452. And I see that right on my screen. But we are supposed to, do that and lose that much money. My colleague, Michelle Belcher, wasn't here today from Grants Pass. She lost $15,000 on underpaid MAC generics in the first quarter. That was on 800 prescriptions. Another thing that is the transparency issue, that is, I really encourage you to read this prescription that I, on this article that I sent in electronically. It's called, it was in Fortune magazine in 2013, and explains the issue of PBM spread. It has to do with, this article was in Fortune, and it's explains, example, what Express Scripts paid for 30 tablets of amoxicillin and what they billed their, the company that was hiring him, the insured, was $92. They kept it. They kept the difference. So that they're the middleman. They are causing an increase in healthcare costs. There's a new breed of PBMs called transparent PBMs, and they're charging like a flat fee for every prescription. But I would really encourage you, especially to look at your state PBMs, and which, by the way, they were exempted from the law in 2013, which I don't agree with. I think they should have to abide by the law, too. They were exempted in our original bill.
They're transparent?
Yeah, they were exempted from 2123. I think that was at the insistence of Tom Burns. So I think it should be looked at. I think the state should have to comply with this same law. But anyway, I would urge you to look at the transparency and the spread issue, because you need to know where your money is going, where the PBM is keeping that kind of spread. So if you want to understand PBMs better, please look at that bill. That article, I'm sorry. Also, our previous bill didn't have any penalties. The Oregon Insurance Commission really didn't have any way to get the PBMs when they didn't obey the law. They were supposed to be able to have a phone number where we could reach them to deal with MACs and MAC appeals. They don't. They still have email and fax for a good many of them. They're supposed to give us a response within 7 days. They don't.
When did that law take effect?
It was passed in 13, parts of it were in 14, and some of it wasn't
it was
till 15.
3 months ago.
Some of it wasn't till January 15. Many rural pharmacies have closed due to losses caused by PBM contracts. They're take it or leave it contracts. If you don't have their contract, you'll lose the whole group that has it. Like, you can lose all the teachers, you can lose all the federal workers, so you're afraid to not sign their contracts. However, if they want to just, and they do, like every couple months, they'll send you another contract and the rate has gone down. And why? Our costs just keep going up. They're making more money. Express Scripts is now the number one out of the top. There's like five PBMs in the country that are huge. Express Scripts merged with Medco. Their CEO is number four on Forbes top 100 highest paid CEOs, $51 million. They're huge. Someone needs to understand this issue of transparency, but it's so complicated and complex, and they like it that way because it's hard to understand. But if someone could really get in and understand it, they could save a lot of money. Because before about late 70s, early 80s, we didn't have PBMs. The pharmacy billed the insurer directly. And I don't know why we can't now, but they're very powerful. They're very expensive. They tell the insurer, we can save you money, but we could save you money if we billed you directly. But that's what we deal with every day. Federally, the government is looking at why generics are increasing at such a rate. But what we deal with is that we, when the PBMs don't update the prices, we're stuck with these huge market jumps like this. And we're supposed to dispense it. And we want the right to say, no, we're not going to fill that prescription because your PBM didn't pay us. And I think that would help the marketplace, because then the customers would complain, and then the PBM would get flack, and they'd pick a better PBM. Okay, thank you very much.
You don't have to get too close.
Sure, well, Ann pretty well covered a lot of it anyway. I'm Jerry Inchipal. I own a small pharmacy over in Baker City, other side of the state, but really nice. To kind of cover some of what Ann just covered too, was I experienced one of these price increases that Ann was looking at, and on one medication, and we're required to dispense it, I lost $400. So in looking at this process, I thought, okay, that price went up fast enough that maybe the PBMs did not catch the price increase yet. So I let that ride and did check in with my group contractors to be following up with this. The next month, the same thing come through again. Again, another $400 loss. So in a 30-day period, they did not change their pricing system. So I did, and again, contact my group purchasing and ask them what was going on. And they told me that the PBM that I was working with had changed their price structure in some areas of the country, but not on ours. So that's kind of leaving me like, well, they know the price is up there. How come this is not a fair market change? And they said basically because we're not having enough complaints from your area. So I tried to get a hold of the PBM, too, by phone, and as Ann mentioned, that good luck trying to do that. Nobody seems to know where these pricing contractors are within their company. I am not a businessman, and I own a business, but ask my wife. I just don't do that well. I'm a pharmacist. I want to take my time to look at drug interactions. I want to visit with the doctors about what's going on with your prescriptions. Work with your moms and dads because they don't understand that. I don't want to be looking at, am I going to be able to stay open because of this? I'm sorry, but I want to be a pharmacist. But thank you.
Thank you. You're quite welcome. I'm going to close the hearing.
Mr. Holt.
Oh, one more. I'm sorry.
No problem.
You showed up there.
I snuck in.
My intention is to close the hearing on this bill, open the hearing on the other PBM bill, and ask for witnesses for anybody who's come from out of the area. If there aren't enough people, I mean, we can carry it over to the following.
You did.
They're both open.
You did that, Mr. Chair.
I know I opened both of them.
Okay.
What I'm saying is I want to close this one. And keep the other one open only for people who've come from a distance. We'll carry that other one over to get other testimony next week if we need to. So please go ahead.
Okay. My name is Jack Holt, and I'm the president of High School Pharmacy, a regional chain of locally owned pharmacies. I've been a licensed pharmacist in the state of Oregon since 1982, currently own 10 pharmacies. My pharmacies are in Cave Junction, Walport, Clatskanie, Sheridan, Independence, Mount Angel, Estacada, and are the only pharmacies in their respective communities. I'm here to testify on behalf of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2875. Community pharmacy is currently alive in our state, but it's definitely not well. While I am forever the optimist with regard to the viability of my profession, when I look at the current financial picture facing us, I begin to question my optimistic outlook. Last year, in 2014, my 10 stores generated $42 million in general revenue, providing employment to over 280 employees, people living in the state of Oregon. This resulted in a net profit before taxes of 1.8%. I could almost do as good with just putting my money in a CD. The three of my pharmacies continue to operate at a net loss of almost $350,000 this last year. 95% of all our prescriptions are processed through pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs, which is why if community pharmacies are to remain viable to serve the towns in which they are to exist, we need to have your vote to approve the proposed amendments, which address two of the largest obstacles we face in pharmacy in Oregon today, the maximum allowable cost, transparency, and the enforcement of HB 2875. In the first quarter of this year, we had 15,357 claims reimbursed below our cost in the first quarter of this year alone. We sent in the appropriate MAC appeals through our PSAO, our pharmacy service provider. Over the 15,000 prescriptions filled at a loss to the pharmacy, 44.5%, almost half, were outright denied with little to no explanation, resulting in an average loss of $9.26 per prescription, below what I could buy it for. 11.43% were increased, which was good, resulting in an average increase of $6.63 per prescription. 32.53% received no response at all, resulting in an average loss of $8.75 per prescription. And 10.9% were paid at contracted rate. The passage of HB 2875 was large, but now we must address the continued problem of having a system in place that is not transparent. It's not based upon actual prices the community pharmacy can purchase the medications needed to fill the prescriptions at and can be changed without explanation by any of the PBMs. The proposed amendments do not address many of the issues at hand or do address many of the issues at hand. I had a meeting last fall with the former executive vice president of a large PBM who explained the MAC system this way. If you think they have anything to do with the actual cost of the drug, you are mistaken. It is about profits for the PBM. What you pay for the drugs are irrelevant. I was in charge of managing the MAC program for my PBM, and when the president came in and said to my office and said, we are not meeting our profit goals, we need another $20 million by the end of the week, I turned the dial on the computer, collected the additional $20 million in profits from the pharmacies, and then turned it back. That is how MAC pricing works. In addition, we must have in place some way of enforcing HB 2875. They can request that the PBMs comply with the current law, but when frequently ignored, that they can do nothing about it. These amendments help address this problem. And here's a quote from our current PSAO that I received yesterday. As for the Oregon Commission, the insurance commission they're referring to, they do not respond to complaints filed against PBMs and have not yet provided an appropriate way to file complaints. There are no PBMs compliant with Section 11 MAC transparency. But without a clear complaint process at the Oregon Commission, it has been impossible to provide the information they will need to oversee compliance with the law. The proposed amendment requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt the necessary rules, as well as provide them with the tools to require compliance with the PBM.
To wrap it up, please.
Thank you for your time and consideration of this important issue facing pharmacy. Right on down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
I do. But
we've got five more bills to hear.
You know what?
So there's no hurry.
I'll take it up later because it'll take time.
I just want to thank the people who came from far away. I remember you coming in 2013 and how impressed I was then. I am really discouraged at how little that bill did. I had a lot of hopes. I'm remembering Jules Bailey and all of his work on this.
The bill's only been in effect
3 months, so we're
okay,
not
good.
Sure
but thank you so much for coming again and sharing this with us.
Thank you.
It's really outrageous.
We're going to take this seriously. I did close the public hearing on
just total outrage
on 3178, and that testimony was on 2875.
Okay.
Can I find out who on 2875 has come from out of town?
You have Sean Murray, Patrick Bowman.
Sean Murray from out of town?
Yes, he's greater than 100 miles.
Let's go.
Patrick Bowman, Sean Murray. Right. Patrick can come up. And then we have Cindy Laubacher, who's greater than 100 miles. Laubacher.
I can barely contain discuss. Not that I'm passionate about many things.
Did anybody else on this bill?
Okay, Sean didn't want to speak.
Okay, guys, go for it. We're going to carry this one over when you're done.
Ready?
Go for it.
Okay. Hi, Representative Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Bowman. I'm a pharmacist at Tualatin Pharmacy, which I own and operate, and I'm an independent pharmacy with the Good Neighbor Pharmacy System. You probably have heard of them. My father and sister are also both pharmacists in Portland and also Good Neighbor pharmacists as well. Me and many more just like me are going through the same struggles that you just heard of. And I'm very much in support of this bill for several reasons. Currently, the state of Oregon, through the Insurance Commission, has absolutely no teeth in what they're doing. Absolutely none. There is no clause in the current law that if a PBM decides to ignore procedure or protocol, then there's no action to be taken. There's nothing. It stops. And that's what's going on right now. Time is really important on this issue because, as the previous speaker spoke of, when you fill a prescription and maybe lose $200, that was my example, I lost $200, just remember that most of these medications are maintenance medications. So I'm going to repeat that 11 more times this year. That's going to be quite a bit of loss. And there's no way you can make up a $200 loss on one item. My appeals that I have personally filed with the state insurance commissioner have gotten me nothing. I have never had a single one come back to my favor. One time I forgot to cross a T and they misinterpreted something and it was rejected. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous what's going on with appeals. My group, Good Neighbor Pharmacy, filed 737 appeals in the last 12 months. 51% of those were declined. 13% of those never even got a response. Now remember, there's supposed to be a time period where they respond
to. I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't want to break your train of thought, but were those appeals with the PBM or appeals with the insurance division? Because I think that's a pretty important thing for me to understand.
Those were with the insurance commission.
700 appeals?
Those were with the PBM.
Okay.
So I filed four with the insurance commission. Yeah, that
okay,
would be
thank
quite
you.
A difference.
Okay, no, okay. That's all right.
The
okay.
insurance commission is much happier now.
Well, I'm getting to that, but
okay.
At any rate.
Get to it quickly.
Yeah, we're almost done here. This is going to result in these kind of losses in a decrease in my margins. And as you just heard, the price of medications go up without recognitions from the PBM. Decreasing margin, increasing costs means less access for patients to Good Neighbor pharmacies. And I can tell you that's a very real thing. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and Member, Cindy Laubacher with Express Scripts. We are here in opposition to the Dash 1 amendments to 2875. I'll put something in writing, more detail, so I'll try and keep my comments limited. We are deeply concerned about these amendments that we came upon this morning. And there are a number of problems, issues that were discussed at length over the course of 18 months worth of negotiation are suddenly back and rewritten and considered technical. But most troubling is a provision in the new draft that will guarantee that our plan sponsors pay reimburse the pharmacies at cost. What that means is there's no incentive for the pharmacies to purchase drugs at a discounted price. There's no it removes any incentive for wholesalers to discount, provide any discounts to pharmacies when or the PSAOs that the pharmacies work through, and therefore we're going to see increased costs for both members and plan sponsors.
I want to ask a question.
Go for it.
So. I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, but I don't understand something. When the pharmacist comes up and says, I lost $200 on a script, can you explain how that happens? Because I think that's what we're reacting to. We don't understand. They bill for a drug, and then they can't charge the price that it costs them. That's what we're confused about.
Certainly. Chair Greenlick, Representative Notes, the way it works is it works a couple of ways, but what could happen is so a pharmacy may purchase their drugs, the product they keep on their shelves. They may purchase it directly through a wholesaler, or they may purchase it through a PSAO, which is essentially a group purchasing organization.
Okay.
That so it allows them to sort of get the benefit of bulk purchasing.
Okay.
So the if they are purchasing directly through a PSAO, they are relying on that PSAO to drive a discounted rate or price for those drugs, those products, from the wholesaler on their behalf. So it may be that their PSAO is just not doing a good job. You know, one of the problems with this bill is it only looks at PBMs. And there are wholesalers involved in this transaction. There are PSAOs involved in this transaction. So it may be that they just don't have a very good PSAO, or they're not holding their PSAO accountable. Yes,
you wouldn't have a problem with them not having to fill a prescription if they can't get reimbursed for their costs. Would that be a problem for you?
Chair Greenlick, yes, that is a problem for us. Our
don't want to pay them costs, but you want to insist they fill a prescription below their costs. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Greenlick, what MAC was set up to do MAC was created by the federal government for Medicaid for the purpose of incentivizing pharmacies to buy at the best rate possible. In the scheme of purchasing in any retail setting, including pharmacy, what happens is and this is true for us, we purchase medications.
Question was pretty
we make
simple.
Drugs. Well, and
I have a pretty simple question.
Sure.
You want to have the right not to pay them the cost of the drugs, but you also don't want them to have the right not to fill a prescription if they can't get paid the cost of the drugs. Is that your Express Scripts position?
Chair Greenlick, what we want in our contracts and what they don't talk about is the money they're making on drugs. So they may be losing on some and making money on others. So the way it works, the way the system is set up, is that on the whole, they should be making more money. That's the way the system
I'm
works.
I'm not sure I've gotten the answer clear. You don't want to be required to pay them the cost of the drugs, but you do want to require them to fill prescriptions under your contract when they have to fill it below the cost of the drugs. Is that your position? Is that Express Scripts' position? I just want to make sure we have on the record what you're saying, because it will help our deliberations, because we're certainly not going to allow something like that to happen. Is that your position?
Chair Greenlick, the it's more complicated than that, but
that's a simple question. I can put you under oath if you'd like. We have the ability to do that. I have a very simple question. You want to have the ability not to have to pay them the cost of their drugs, but you also want to have the ability in your contract to make them fill a prescription below the cost.
Chair Greenlick, we don't know what the cost of their drug is. We're not privy to that information.
You don't have a problem. Then you would not have a problem from deleting that from your contracts. So they know what the cost of the drug is, and they know what you're going to give them. Mm-hmm. You don't have a problem with deleting from your contracts if they have to fill the prescription, even if it's below, even if you're willing to pay them less than what they have to pay for that prescription.
Chair Greenlick, no, we would not support that for the reason that we don't know what they're purchasing. So at the point that a patient goes in to get a prescription filled, we don't know what they paid. We don't know if they're going to make more on that prescription or less on that prescription. So that would happen. That happens later in the process. Do we want patients there's no way for it. What I'm trying to explain is there's no way for, at the point of the transaction, there's no way for anyone to know that.
They know. At the point of transaction, what they paid for their drug.
Actually, Mr. Chair, may I ask?
Yeah, well, I think we need to close this, but...
Well, it works right in conjunction with what you're saying.
Go ahead.
I guess since you're... wouldn't be willing to pay them the cost of the prescription, would you be willing to give them the extra spread that you make when you're making an extra $200 on it?
Schedule it to next Friday.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Widener. Widener, I apologize. The issue of spread is one between us and our clients. Not all of our clients are spread clients, so I wouldn't necessarily know whether or not that's their spread in that particular transaction or not. So some clients they get billed exactly what the pharmacy pays is exactly what the client pays. In other circumstances where there is spread exists everywhere in retail. That is something that the clients determine whether or not they want that in their contracts with us.
I'm going to close the hearing on these two bills now and reopen and carry them over till Monday, both bills. If any of you want to testify between now and on Monday, would you please get in touch with the administrator so we have a sense of what's happening? And I do need to comment that I can't believe public policy would allow contracts in our state that would refuse to pay for the cost of a drug but require them to fill a prescription even if it's below the cost of a drug. I do not think that's good public policy. Close the public hearing to carry it over on 2875. I already closed 3178. I'm sorry, and we'll carry them over. We're going to reschedule House Bill 3427 to next Friday.
Thank you.
Is the plan. So we're going to close that. We opened that. We're going to close that.
Okay,
let's open the public hearing or reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3200. Call the first panel, and I'm going to again ask you all to be as brief as possible. I think we've overscheduled this. We got out 30 minutes early the last time we were here.
That's what we're making up for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim Gardner.
I'm so disgusted.
Bill Toffler. We're in support.
And then hello, Professor Toffler.
I had to go take a walk.
Is he allowed to call you by your first name? In
he
this
is.
Setting?
He is. We're old colleagues. And one other, or is that it?
Everybody else is in opposition. So I just called the proponents first.
Mr. Gardner cannot be in favor of something that we had before us. It just doesn't happen. Well, let's hear you. It'd be nice to hear that, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Pharma in support of House Bill 3200.
Hear that, guys.
Hey, I heard you.
Emphatic support of House Bill 3200. This is a bill that echoes, in a sense, one of the key provisions of the anti-discrimination section of the Affordable Care Act, the Federal Affordable Care Act, which, in addition to prohibiting discrimination on the basis of age, also prohibits discrimination on the basis of expected length of life, diagnosis, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life. This is one of the more important protections. The limitation of the ACA protection is that it applies by its terms only to the Medicaid expansion population, which was created by the ACA itself. This protection that would be afforded by House Bill 3200 would be broader. And it would protect against essentially age discrimination in the provision of health insurance. There are two concerns that have been brought to my attention that I'd like to address by the OMA, both of which I think can be remedied with the consent of the sponsors. The first is the remedy itself is a criminal remedy. I'm not certain that that's the right kind of remedy here. Another approach might be to embed the remedy in the suite of remedies that already exist for other kinds of discrimination, housing, employment, et cetera. And we'd be delighted to work with the committee on crafting that technical change if it would be helpful. And the second is the bill by its terms applies not merely to health insurers but to health providers. And that may itself be inappropriate. We think that the real focus ought to be on policies by insurers that discriminate on the basis of age, because providers, we don't think that the problem is provider hesitancy to serve an aging population. And this population, by the way, is growing, is increasingly a subject that will be receiving attention from groups like this. The Centers for Disease Control recently reported that the average length of life for America's population has risen to an all-time high of 78.7. And those 65 years and old, of age and older, obviously have long lives ahead of them, and they respond very well to good state-of-the-art medical treatment, and that should not be denied on the basis of age. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner. Professor Toffler.
Well, Professor Greenlick and the members of the committee, I appreciate your time. And I've been very impressed this afternoon with your patience through the hearing as well. Hopefully you can be patient.
We're used to dealing with walk-ins. It's a big problem.
I see. I'm a walk-in, too, though, so I can't rise above that. Anyway, I do want to agree with everything that was just said, with one exception. And I'm a provider. I've been in the state of Oregon as a professor of family medicine now at OHSU for the better part of 30 years, and practiced in Sweet Home for 6 years before that. I do experience discrimination based on age among my colleagues at times, where it's sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit. In 1994, one of the doctors in UK actually said, older people have enjoyed more life and have less life to enjoy. Therefore, age is ethical, objective, cost-effective criterion for rationing. Age is and flourishes in secret. I would agree with him that is the mentality. There are a million doctors. They don't all agree with my perception about the inherent value of life at different ages. It's not just isolated. I did a Medline search this morning. There are 127 articles since 1996 that deal with this issue. They document 90% of older Americans never receive routine screening tests. That's also in the ACA. 60% of older adults don't receive routine preventive health services. 35% of doctors continue to believe, despite ample evidence to the contrary, that hypertension is a normal part of aging. It's also young medical students at one of our prestigious institutions, Johns Hopkins. 80% would treat aggressively a pneumonia in a 10-year-old, and only do 56% of them would do it for a person age 85. If you look at this graph, this is by one of the more premier bioethicists in the United States, Ezekiel Emanuel, along with a couple of his colleagues. I'm over here on the right hand of the bar, and so I have a disclosure to make that I'm aging, and so I have an inherent conflict of interest. This means how much services you get in the bar graph on the y-axis. This is a serious paper in which he basically justifies this isn't ageism, because everybody once was 25 and could get more health care services. That's his logic. You can't make this stuff up. He really is serious about that. He also wants to die himself.
Sure, you can make
why that. I hope to die at 75. And that's fine for Dr. Emanuel. I don't agree with him. I hope to live well until I die naturally at whatever age. A thoughtful geriatrician reacted to his comment and said something along the lines, he's confusing chronologic age with functional age. And so I think all of us ought to be respectful of all people and allow them to make decisions. And unfortunately, when you have this logic, it gets into a state-controlled situation of who gets what at what age, and it is sad. They document with qualitative remarks, and I won't go through them all. Elderly patients present obstacles to getting the whole story, getting the truth out. It's not just physically human possible to take care of these people. We've already heard about how we are now inverting permit as I and others age. This is also true in my own practice. I mentioned that I take care of elderly people. As I age, your practice ages with you often, although I still do OB. But one of my patients was 98 years old, only about 13 months ago, admitted to the hospital with abdominal pain. They did a basic workup, admitted to the hospital, thought it was constipation causing him not to be able to void, did basic screening tests and x-ray. He got better with the constipation, discharged him, never really investigated very deeply. He gets admitted to the ER, goes to the ER two weeks later. He finds at this point that he has the same problem. They managed to mitigate it a little bit with pain medicines at ED. I happened to cruise by, talked to one of my colleagues, said, you know, we really ought to investigate. This guy doesn't generally complain. I knew him well. I've been taking care of him for a decade. They find a hernia with a CT that is going, the bladder's going into the hernia. That's why he couldn't void, not the constipation. All he needed was a CT, which would have been done with a 30-year-old, would have been done with a 50-year-old. But everybody was hesitant. Even the surgeon, these are excellent people, by the way. These are not bad people. He said, well, I don't know if we're going to do him any good because, you know, that may not be his problem. It's a simple hernia repair, getting the bladder out of it. I talked him into doing that. You have to be an advocate now when you're older. You have to have an advocate, I should say, when you're older. And he did just fine. He's going to be celebrating his 100th birthday with about 400 or 500 people in 11 days. I already disclosed that I am aging. I deeply care about aging. I'm 66 now and continue to age. Therefore, I do have that inherent conflict of interest. Thank you for letting me tell
you. You're a youngster, though.
You hold your age well, Mitch.
Even I can say that.
At 80, I have a different perspective about
it. Well, you know, it shouldn't be a political issue whether a Democrat or a Republican. Wyden testified exactly what I'm saying when he was in the early 2000s in Congress. This is not, to me, it would have been mom and apples pies. Again, it's a dangerous situation. I want medical students, even if you don't have an enforcement policy, I want medical students to hear that we shouldn't be making decisions arbitrarily on age alone. Functional physiology?
Bill, I want to ask you a question.
Sure, I figured you would.
There are medical practices now that are throwing people out of their practice when they get to Medicare age. Would you consider that a violation of this law?
See, ask that question again. I couldn't quite hear it.
There are medical practices. Jim, you might comment on this. There are medical practices that when somebody gets to be Medicare age, they're thrown off their practice.
That is true. In fact, it's interesting.
Is that a violation of this bill?
I think that they're separate issues. Their decision-making taking place at the bedside of hospitals, whether they're Medicare or not, whether they're undocumented in this country or whatever, their decisions being made at the bedside. And I give you stories about that as well. They have closed practices that began on the coast in rural areas. My own chairman got upset about that. He said, with righteous indignation, but now we send our Medicaid patients to Richmond.
I'm not talking about closed practices. I'm talking about a practice where a patient has been seen for a decade, gets to be 65, and they're thrown off the practice.
I think it's bad. We grandfathered.
I wonder whether it's a violation of this.
Mr. Chairman, it might be. I think that is that's a real possibility. And I guess that would weigh in your deliberations about whether or not a narrowing to health insurers is appropriate or not appropriate, as I suggested earlier on in my testimony.
Okay.
Carry this over to Monday.
Yeah, I'm going to carry this one over to Monday as well. I think all the people in opposition are folks who hang out here for a living. Folks, public hearing on House Bill 3200.
Open a
public hearing on House Bill 3132. And
I don't see Representative Helm.
No, he's here. He's here. He's here.
Oh, sorry.
He waited patiently.
Thank
he
you
did.
Very much for your patient wait. We have 12 minutes.
And getting educated.
And we
today.
Have Cheryl Ramirez, Mark Campbell, Chris Fick.
Okay. Come on up.
I'll go ahead and get going to save you time. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, co-chair.
I'm sorry that we got your bill in this position.
No problem. My name is Ken Helm. I'm representative for House District 34 and most of Beaverton, Cedar Hills, West Haven. Representative Barbara Smith Warner and I decided to co-sponsor this bill because it's one that particularly affects large counties, I think. The county that I live in, Washington County, is the second largest of the state, which you know. And we do have great needs for folks suffering from domestic violence and having trouble with drug addiction and mental illness in the form of a place to go when they really need it the most. When they're experiencing trouble from any of those maladies, particularly domestic violence, they need a facility to leave the situation that they're in and go to have someplace safe to spend the night or a couple of days. This is a bill that essentially authorized something called conduit bonding. And please don't ask me what that means, because I'll just make something up to get through this. And we'll leave that to some of the smart financing people. But essentially, it's a bonding mechanism that that allows the providers of these services a cheaper way to build their facilities so that they can use more of their budget for the services that they provide. And I'm reminded in this of my old boss's statement about public facilities. You know, former Representative Mike Burton, who is the executive officer of Metro for many years, used to say, we have an edifice complex. Not Oedipus, edifice. In that we're eager to build buildings, especially public buildings, with lots of public money. Then we don't save enough money to run them. And that happens with our healthcare facilities, too. And I view this as a way to get away from that. So it's a good thing. Let me just give you a couple of numbers here. And I was watching your previous testimony, and there are a lot of very heartrending stories out there. And so unfortunately, this information goes right along with it. Oregon is 48th in the nation for the portion of adults who need treatment for drug abuse. And that have actually received that treatment. And we're fifth highest in the percentage of adults who have misused or are addicted to illegal drugs. On the domestic violence front, about 4,800 Oregon adults and children were forced to spend an average of 25 nights in a shelter provided by a domestic violence program in 2015. In 2013, nearly 12,000 requests for shelter from domestic violence went unmet because the programs were unable to meet the need. These are people that are calling and saying, I've got a situation that I need to get away from. We don't have a place to send them. So I will wrap up there with the statement that it looks like we can approve a mechanism to make bonding funding easier for these types of facility providers, the behavioral treatment facility.
And this is a source of bonding that's available for health facilities, right. Nonprofit health facilities. Right. But these kind of facilities are not included into that bonding. Mm-hmm. And what this bill would do would be to move them into the eligibility for that kind of bond funding.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And you can see it's a very simple bill to define those facilities and bring them into the list.
And it doesn't cost us any extra money. It's simply a way to get into.
And that's my final point, not a
tax-exempt bonding, right?
Yeah. With that, thank you very much for having a public hearing on this bill for both Representative Smith Warner and myself.
We have a couple of people who want to talk about it.
Mark Campbell, Chris is Fick. And then Cheryl Ramirez.
And then you guys have 6 minutes, so you have about a minute and a half each if you talk fast. And then the next committee is coming in here and throwing us out.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, other members of the committee. I'm Chris Fick with Multnomah County. I am here daily, so I will yield my time to Mr. Campbell and be happy to answer any questions.
But you support this?
Very supportive, yes, sir.
Okay, that's what we need to know. We won't reopen this hearing. We'll consider moving to work session next.
Thank you, Chris.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Mark Campbell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide some background on this bill. As you heard from Representative Helm, statutes permit local governments to create public authorities to issue tax-exempt conduit bonds for hospitals that provide long-term resident and facilities that provide long-term residential care for the elderly and disabled. Multnomah County created its authority in December of 1998. Since that time, we've issued over $500 million of conduit bonds on behalf of creditworthy nonprofit organizations that operate these facilities to finance or refinance construction projects. This would enable, the bill before you today would enable the Multnomah County Hospital Facilities Authority to provide nonprofit operators of facilities that provide services to those suffering from mental illness, struggling with addiction, or fleeing domestic violence with the same access to low-cost financing available to hospitals and retirement homes. Over the past few years, I've been approached from time to time by nonprofit organizations seeking assistance from the Hospital Facilities Authority for projects that we've had to turn down because they didn't meet the statutory requirement in the current bill, in the current statute. Perhaps the most typical inquiry has been for the construction or renovation of a facility that provides care for people experiencing mental illness or struggling with addiction. It's always seemed to me that these facilities perform a similar function to that of hospitals and long-term care facilities for the elderly and disabled. To provide a sense of the magnitude, we examine the difference to an organization utilizing a Multnomah County Hospital Financing Authority financing instead of a loan from a bank or traditional funding source. As a rough rule of thumb, we determine that for every $10 million that an organization is able to borrow through the HFA instead of from a traditional source, that organization could expect to save between $75,000 and $100,000 a year for 20 years. These savings would enable an organization providing residential mental and substance abuse care in Multnomah County to hire two or three additional employees. Hospitals and long-term care facilities align with the county's mission to provide a functioning safety net for its residents. Similarly, organizations in House Bill 3132 also align with this role, and expanding the hospital facility authority is a reasonable, no-cost way to further support those organizations.
Can I short-circuit you? And ask you a simple question that any of you can. Is there any reason why we shouldn't do this?
I can't think of one.
Good. Can you move on?
Yes.
You got five votes. You don't need to go for four. Please.
Greenlight members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez, Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I would just like to express our support for House Bill 3132, broadening the county authority to issue conduit bonds to allow organizations to build mental health treatment facilities will further expand community-based alternatives, which will prevent more restrictive institutional care or incarceration. This is good for the people we serve, and it is congruent with our USDOJ agreement. Thank you.
Perfect testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll consider moving this out. What do I need to do?
I just want you to repeat what we've done with this.
Tell me what we're going to do.
I believe that we're carrying over the rest of the public hearing on House Bill 3200 to Monday, and the two public pharmacy benefit manager bill for the remainder of the folks that had signed up, 2875 and 3178, are carried over to Monday as well for public hearings. And we have Representative Bueller. Is raising his hand.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Quick question.
Yep.
Is there unlimited bonding capacity?
It's not, Representative Bueller, it's not unlimited, but there isn't anything in statute that says how much that you can have authority for.
And the person that will have to pay back the bond is not the county, it's the facility, is that right?
That's correct.
So the county's just a conduit, probably why it's called conduit funding.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. They would just have to factor in their total indebtedness to their credit rating, probably.
Excuse me?
The county would just need to make sure their credit rating isn't affected by total indebtedness all across the boards. So that'd probably be the only real limiting factor here, I would think.
Well, but the county doesn't have indebtedness, is that right?
Correct. Representative Clem, the county doesn't have this indebtedness. It doesn't count against our debt capacity. And as Representative Greenlick pointed out, it's an obligation of the borrower to pay this off.
Just
okay.
Seems
like we should do this. Thank you very much. close the public hearing on House Bill 3132 and adjourn. Thank you for your patience, guys. Adjourn. Thank you for your patience, guys.